All right, Glenn. As a caveat here, while I have said that I have heard music that claims to be based upon the notes given to us in the Psalms of Dodd, and that those notes are derived from the letters themselves, just as the letters convey numbers, there's also evidence that these numbers can convey musical notes. So, but I've said that I'm not a musician, and all I know is that's the claim, and I've listened to the music that that claims to be based on this. All right, so I had 7 minutes to pretend to be more expert during the break. But I've never claimed to be any more expert than what I've just shared. But I did, and I went to about 15 different sites, all of which were just rubbish in what they claimed. I found one that is at least interesting, and what it does is it takes the Pythagorean formula, and I don't know why it uses the Pythagorean numbers, but it applies them to Psalm 119. And Psalm 119 is the clearest indication of song, of chorus and refrain that there is in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. 172 total verses, 8 verses to each of the 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet and alphabetical order. So, you know, if you're going to find it, that's the place I'd look. And then what he did is took each of the Hebrew letters and assigned a number value to them. And then he went through the verses, 1, 9, 17, going through the, there are 8 verses for each of the 22 letters, and came up with a mathematical scale. And then derived 1 and 7 is the note A, 2 and 8 are B, 3 and 9 are C, 4 is D, 5 is F, 6 is G. And so he used that methodology to come up with the musical notes, and then you can click on his implementation of that formula. So there's at least somebody that provides the methodology. In this short of time, I was unable to verify whether or not it's valid. But
who better to bring insight to Hebrew music than a Greek mathematician?
Yeah, I think that while the Pythagorean numbers are, of course, a Greek mathematician's formula, and I don't know why he went there, The fact is that most of what the Greek mathematicians did was related to what I think is the most logical, graphic, symbolic map the world has ever known, which is geometry.
Right.
And so most of Greek math is based on geometry. And as a result of that, you know, we would give a Greek name to it because a Greek is the one that made the calculations famous. Greeks did. The fact is, we should not be surprised, as graphic, as symbolic as Yahweh is, as illustrative as he is in his in everything that he does, and as calculation based as he is. You know, I would not be surprised that in geometry we find the patterns that can be applied to the 22 Hebrew letters to create a musical score.
Yeah, I did the same thing. What I got was Metallica for some reason, but I don't know. Anyway, my initial knee-jerk reaction was, what the? Musical scores.
I don't know. Have you seen, if you go to Larry's Facebook site, Inconvenient Truth, his web presence there has, kind of gone out of its way to present a number of things that are really thought provoking. One of them is the calculations. You know, we all know that Hebrew letters represent numbers, and that in fact what we call Arabic numbers are actually Hebrew numbers, and that the numbering system in Hebrew is really quite advanced, and those numbers can be applied to any word or anything that is conveyed in Hebrew. And so this fellow decided to use those numbers to apply them to the key Hebrew words. And, you know, things like light conveyed actually the speed of light. But he went through, and it was hundreds of words talking about how the math of creation, the math of our universal reality is all in the Hebrew words themselves. I started listening to it. I haven't listened to the whole thing, but I know it's available, and we'll have Scott who is in contact with Larry regularly, as I am, but on his Facebook site. I'm sure Scott can get it and put it on the Facebook site for Shattering Myths, Facebook site that Scott has, and we'll get it out to people. But I don't think this is an if, because I've listened to enough of this, but since Yahweh has communicated using an alphabet that conveys a numerical depiction of creation, I would not be surprised that the letters also convey a musical representation of how his songs were meant to be sung.
Right. It's certainly possible.
I'm naturally inclined to accept it, because it's just so consistent with his nature, and the fact that, you know, you look at DNA, it's a three-dimensional language. And so wouldn't it make sense that the Hebrew language was representation of words, representation of numbers, representation of musical sounds, all at the same time? It's just...
Yeah, possible, but conjectural. Yeah, that speed of light thing, is that in cubits per second?
cubits per second. Yeah, I know. And that was the first thing that I thought of when I was dealing with it. Is it in cubits per second? I know. That's one of the hard things that's associated with taking somebody else's research and saying, you know, I'd recommend this for consideration, because immediately I'm questioning it the same way you're questioning it, and, you know, and I'm not going to invest all the same amount of time to validate. Like, you know, one of these people on the musical note for Yah says that the new musical note for Yah when graphed is the Star of David, showing that there's musical notes. Well, the Star of David has absolutely nothing to do with Yahweh. Yeah, in fact, it's anti-Yahweh.
Yeah,
and so you're just going...
The Rem fan star,
goodness.
Yeah, repudiated by Amos, for sure. But anyway, I didn't want to continue making trouble. I just had to do a little poke of the wrist thing on the whole zone thing a little bit. About the Buck missile. I don't think that's one of those deals where nobody's going to own up, and there's always going to, you know, they're just going to, it's all going to be subterfuge and muddying the water. That's all it's going to be.
You know, I think that we live in a world today where perpetrators, people who set the pieces in motion that led to an inevitable calamity, never take responsibility. And in this case, it's the United States. The United States encouraged the coup and the overthrow of the democratically elected government, and advocated the unification of Kiev and that regime with United States, bribing them with $25 billion and all manner of weapons if they would start a war that would engage the Russians so that NATO could become viable again. And what we did led to this calamity. The United States will never accept responsibility.
Right.
Not zero chance. Now, if in this case, who pulled the trigger and what weapon they deployed in pulling the trigger is irrelevant.
Right.
It's why the trigger was pulled. What events led up to that trigger being pulled that matters? And that's the only thing that matters. Because there is a 0% possibility that either the Kiev regime or those trying to defend themselves from the Kiev regime or the Russians deliberately shot down a commercial airliner. Not one chance in a billion.
Well, there were some questions early on about bullet holes, you know, holes.
Yes. Yeah, if you look at the skin, the only pictures that we've been allowed to see show the skin of the aircraft where there are round holes in very close proximity to each other that do not look like what you would expect from a missile exploding right next to the aircraft. So, you know, as I've looked at the images that we're able to see, it looks like bullet holes, not a missile. But I'm also, while that's what the image shows, I'm also here to tell you that there is no way that somebody on the ground could fire 50 rounds into a small circle on an aircraft at 30,000+ feet. So it's not physically possible to have done so. That being the case, I do want to return to where we were on Zechariah. We were considering the 13th chapter of Zechariah. The reason for that is it tells us everything we need to know about not only Yahweh's ultimate return, but the relationship he is establishing with people to either for or against prior to being there. And the thing that I thought was just so interesting is this last statement. Yahweh was, you know, what about those you injured, those you afflicted, those you caused to die around you, talking to the religious leaders, by your own hand, by, you know, under your control, authority, and influence. You know, the religious leaders like America don't want to ever take responsibility, but Yahweh is a responsibility-oriented individual. He's all about accountability. If you do something that harms others, he's going to hold you accountable. If you harm yourself, then you're the victim and there's no one to hold accountable. But if you are a perpetrator, religious, academic, military, if you're a perpetrator and you harm others, you know, you're advancing a religious concept. And Yahweh is going to ask you the same question he asked these prophets, these religious individuals. But what about those that you injured? Now, these particular people, like so many today, they didn't take responsibility. They said their crippling afflictions came by way of their lover's house, of my lover's house, of love, political correctness, Christianity. We should just all get along and love one another. And this is so very telling. It is if you're thoughtful. They are burned by the sun and blinded. They're diseased and lifeless, offering false testimony and raising weapons of war against the Most High's shepherd, against the Most High's mighty individual, who is closely related and associated with me. Yahweh, of the Corps of Spiritual Helpers, prophetically declares Yahweh. So here's God telling us that they're blinded by the sun. How would you be blinded by the sun in a religious setting? Well, you're blinded by the sun because all of the earth's most prominent religions are sun-based. Christianity, with its halos, and Christmas and Easter, Sunday worship, steeples, Trinity. It's all Babylonian, sun, God-based religion. It grows out of the Roman Catholic Church, which grew out of Imperial Rome, which paid tribute to the unconquerable sun. Mithraism, sun god. Dionysus was the son of the sun. In the Greek religion that was practiced by most Romans, they're burned and blinded by the sun, against the Most High Shepherd. The Christian Jesus Christ is modeled after the Babylonian and Greek and Egyptian gods that were sons of the sun. And by thinking that this individual that is their caricature was God, they're blinded by the sun and not able to see the actual individual, Yahusha. So Yahweh says, muster the Shabbat, muster his spiritual envoys against those that are leading, against the teachers, the rulers, the societal shepherds, so that the flock scatters. You see, Yahweh isn't the God who wants to reach out and save everyone. He's not a God that wants to love everyone. He's not a God that wants to know everyone. He's not a God that listens to everyone. He's all about separation. You're either with him or against him. If you're religious, you're against him. If you're pro-military, you're against him. If you're political, you're against him. Patriotic, you're against him. If you are in any way affiliated with someone claiming to be a societal ruler, a societal shepherd, a academician of some sort, you know, a school of philosophy, then he wants you scattered because he's only reaching out to save his children. Then I will use my hand, Yahweh says, to restore, to return, to renew, to shub the Most High's little ones. Those who are insignificant within the stratosphere of religion and politics, who have no status, which means they're not in the military. Military, everyone has a status. They're not in government, where everybody has a status. They're not in religion, where status is the key aspect, particularly of the most popular religion, Roman Catholicism. It's all about what's your status in the church. So he's going to restore those who have no status, which means they're not in the military, they're not religious, they're not in politics, they're not a government employee where status is the key aspect of one's compensation and access to information and power and influence. They have no status. Yahweh's children have no status among men. They only have status where it matters, which was with Yahweh himself. He says, it shall come to exist, Hayah, in the whole of the land, prophetically predicts Yahweh, two-thirds shall be cut off and die, and one-third shall be spared. Now, he says this as it relates to the Eretz, the land. He doesn't say this regarding the whole world. So if it were the whole world, then, a third of the world surviving, we'd be at over 2 billion people, which means that some 5 billion people, 4.5 billion people would die during the tribulation. But that's not what he's talking about here. Hebrew has a word for the whole world. But when he uses Eretz land, it's almost always in reference to his realm. And in his realm, where he's talking about his little ones, those that have no status, those that he is restoring, he's talking about Yisrael. He's talking about Yehudim. And only one-third of them are going to survive. Yahweh says, and he's now speaking in first person, I will return to this one-third. In the fire, I will refine them as one refines silver. And I will test them as one does gold. They will summon, call upon, proclaim my personal and proper name. And I will answer them. All right, let's begin again. I will return. Who's the speaker? Yahweh. To this one-third. One-third of what? He just said one-third of the land is going, two-thirds are going to, in the land, are going to die, and one-third are going to be restored. So one-third is going to be spared, and two-thirds shall be cut off, karat, uprooted and banished. in the land. Who is he talking to? Does that mean that only one-third of the population of the earth at about 7 billion is going to be spared and going to return to Yahweh? Or does it mean one-third of those who have survived the first 7 years now, nearly 7 years of the tribulation? Now you're talking not about a total number of people, potentially 7 billion, but somewhere between 7 and 14 million. Hugely less of a population pool. Right now there are, about 50% of the world's Jews in Israel. 40% of the world's Jews in Israel. And that number of percentage is going to grow as anti-Semitism grows around the world. So let's say that that ultimately of the 15 million, we think, give or take a million or so Jews that exist in the world today, that there may be, 7 million living in Israel? And two-thirds of those are going to be separated from Yahweh. They will never, even in a spirit of reconciliation and acceptance, they will still reject Yahweh. They will still be religious. They won't respond. No matter how desperate the situation, they will rely upon themselves, their religion, their politics, their military. They will not respond to Yahweh. One-third will. We know, though, this one-third are Israelites because of the statement that comes at the end of this particular verse. This is Zechariah 13:9, but more on that in a moment. One-third. He's going to return to that one-third. He's not returning, therefore, to Christians. He's not returning to the Vatican. He's not returning to Washington, D.C. or New York City. He's not coming to the Americas. He's not coming to Europe. Sure as hell not coming to Mecca. He is returning, he said, to the place where he was pouring out this spirit of reconciliation. There's only one city that has been named in this prophecy. It's Jerusalem. Jerusalem. He's returning to Jerusalem for the one-third that have not been banished of his chosen, his little ones, his children. He's returning to them. This is the day of reconciliation, Yom Kippurim, year 6000 Yah, 2033 on our pagan calendars. If you wanted a pagan all the way, it's sunsets on a Monday evening, 620 in Jerusalem, October 2nd, 2033. I will return. Who's the speaker? Yahweh. Who's returning? Yahweh. Not Jesus Christ. Not Bar Kokhba. Yahweh himself. I'm returning to this one-third. In the fire, I will refine them as one refines and tests them. You know, fire, light, that is what purifies. It's been the metaphor that Yahweh has used throughout the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. He is affirming the role of his radiant energy in purifying. What does the set-apart spirit provide for us? A garment of light. What does the garment of light do? It purifies us. Fire is the ancient world's most tangible symbol of light. Refines them. Just as, you know, you take an enormous amount of gold, of ore, to produce gold. You ever watch the any one of those gold mining shows on the Discovery Channel? Think of the amount of dirt that they have to dig up in the most gold-laden soils on Earth to produce just tiny amounts of gold. You have to go through a lot of useless dirt to find something that is refinable as gold. And that's what God says. I'm going to process through all of this just to get these nuggets, my children. And what is it that distinguishes them? They do something that no religious person would even conceive of doing. They will kara. They will recite. They will proclaim. They will invite. they will call upon, they will read aloud my personal and proper name. Kara is the basis of Mikra, which are Yahweh's seven invitations each year to meet with him. This particular day is the Mikra of Yom Kippurim, where we are invited to be called out and to come into the presence of the feminine manifestation of Yahweh's light, the Isha. And so here Yahweh is talking about how he's going to use that same fiery light to refine his children, to restore them. In my personal and proper name, they're going to call. Not a single Christian on the planet that would call God by their, by his personal and proper name, Yahweh. There's not a single religious Jew that would do so. Not a single Muslim, not a single socialist, secular humanist. These are Yahweh's children who have come back home. Then he says something that tells us exactly who they are, because in the book of Hosea, Yahweh tells the Israelites, Ephraim, the northern kingdoms in particular, you are no longer my children. But then he tells them, there will come a day where you will become my children, and I will become your God. He's speaking of this day, and he's speaking of this people, and he will say, you are my family. And they will say, Yahweh is our God. This is the time that God is speaking of. This is the time that he predicted in Hosea. The time where he divorced himself from Israel, because Israel was engaged in doing something horrendous, and being religious, and being political, and forming all manner of defense treaties with other countries, and doing everything except relying on Yahweh. And Yahweh here is saying, on that day, we will end our separation, at least with this one-third of my children of Israel. On this day, you will say that Yahweh is our God, and I will say to you that you are my people, my family. Behold, Yahweh's day of return is coming. Yahweh's return. You know, Christians speak of the second coming, and it's not the second coming, it's the seventh. And they speak of it's Jesus' coming. It's not Jesus', it's Yahweh's. You know, if they would just read the book that they lug around, they'd be enlightened by Yahweh's own testimony. It's Yahweh that's coming. And he's not coming for a church. He's not coming for a country like America. He's coming for his children. This is Yahweh's day of return. It's coming. Pay attention. A day is coming to approach Yahweh. What is the day to approach Yahweh? Well, Pesach is the day of immortality. Matzah is the day of perfection. Bukurim is the day of adoption. Shavuah is the day of enrichment and empowerment. Teruah is the day of announcing Yahweh's message to the world. Kippurim. That's the day of reconciliation. That's the day of restoration. Yahweh said that he's going to restore his children on this day. Well, there is a day to approach Yahweh, a day to restore the relationship. It is Yom Kippurim. He says, pay attention. A day is coming to approach Yahweh. And then that which is good and valuable will be apportioned and assigned in your midst. What's good and valuable? The Torah. Yahweh says that he's going to write his Torah inside of his children on this day. That's good and valuable. His children will be reintegrated into the covenant relationship. That's good and valuable. They'll become immortal, perfect, adopted children, empowered and enriched, and able to camp out with him for all eternity. That's what's going to be apportioned and assigned in the midst of the one-third of Israelites who return home on this day. And he says, I will gather all the people from different races and places to Jerusalem for the battle. The city will be seized, the family and houses shall be plundered, and the women will be raped. And half of the inhabitants of the city shall leave as exiles, but the remainder of the people shall not be cut off or banished from the city. He's telling you the timing of his return. The ultimate assault on Jerusalem, where in Armageddon, after the Magog War, after World War III, we're now in World War IV. Two wars fought over the span of 7 years. That finally Yahweh says, I just want to bring this all to fruition. It's time we clean house. You're on one side of the divide or another. So all of the world's people are going to be gathered, coming to Jerusalem for battle, to wage war. They're going to be in opposition to Yahweh's family. That's why he told us initially that if you're part of his children, if you're part of that one-third who has chosen to reunite with him, you'll be spared. You're going to be restored. You have nothing to worry about. But if you're not, understand that those who are assaulting Jerusalem are going to be engaged in rape, plunder, and arson, and murder. That's the consequence of man's behavior. It's man's armies that are going to inflict this savagery upon humanity. So you want to know when Yahweh is going to return? It's when Jerusalem comes under siege. So when America, Europe, Russia, and all of the Islamic countries collectively decide that, you know, I think what we want to do is besiege Jerusalem. When Jerusalem itself is attacked by the world's militaries is when he's going to return. Now, if you want to look at it on his calendar, he told you, I'm going to come on his day, on the Kara of Restoration, Yom Kippurim. So he's going to come on Yom Kippurim. All you have to do is figure out when, and to do that, all you need to do is look at Yahweh's calendar of how human history and a plan of reconciliation has played out over 7,000 years, including the 1,000-year celebration of the Moed Mikre of Sukkah. So to do that, he has to come back in year 6,000 Yahweh, which just so happens to be 33 CE on our Roman Catholic pagan calendars. Then Yahweh will come forth to oppose the Gentiles. What is the church? Gentile. What is Islam? Gentile. Yahweh will come forth to oppose the Gentiles. He is returning to engage in battle on that day himself in their midst. Yahweh is going to oppose those who oppose his children. Yep, that's the nature of God. He is not a coexister. He's not tolerant. He hates those that threaten his children, as should every parent. So that's the day that he's going to come forth. He's coming forth in opposition. He's not coming forth in love. He's not coming forth wearing a big smile. He's coming forth in opposition to the world's militaries, to the world's politicians, to the world's religious leaders. Coming for those without any status, his children. On that day, he will present himself, his feet standing upon the Mount of Olives, which relationally faces Jerusalem on the east. When Yosha left, where did he leave from? Didn't he not say that he was returning to the Mount of Olives? What is the Mount of Olives symbol of? You know, you've got Mount Moriah, which means to revere Yah, where the first of the Mikre were fulfilled. Pesach, Matzah B'Kodem. All right there on Mount Moriah. And then you have the realization that Yahweh tells us over and over again that the second of the three mountains in Jerusalem, Zion, is the signpost along the way. Zion represents the Torah. It represents his teaching, his signs, his symbols that he has given us to point the way home. And then, of course, you have the Mount of Olives, the Olivet Discourse, where Yahweh, in the form of this, of his shepherd, in the form of his mighty man, told us what was going to happen as time progressed, and he presented the future of the world right out of the pages of Zechariah and told us that he would return to this very place that he was having this prophetic discussion with those who were learning from him, his disciples. So on that day, he will present himself, his feet standing upon the Mount of Olives. Olives represent this, the light that comes from olive oil, the set-apart spirit, her garment of light. And all the symbols that come with olives, including the light that comes from the menorah and the olive lamps, purest light in the ancient world. The healing ointment of olives, being set apart and prepared to serve, that comes from the anointment of olive oil. The nurturing, nutritional benefit of olive oil. All of that. The fact that the olive is the longest lived tree in that part of the world, in the land. All convey the nature of the olive. An olive is even something like bread itself. Like the kernel of grain needs to be crushed. Wine, the symbol of Pesach, needs to be crushed to create wine. The grain needs to be crushed to create bread. The olive needs to be crushed to create olive oil. He's refining us, preparing us, so that we can be his children, empowered, on this day that he returns for his children, in opposition to all forms of human governance, political, religious, and military. All for the benefit of his children.